This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. You've traveled all over. You've met all kinds of people, from government officials to farm workers. In your travels, what have you learned about humanity?
That's a great question, and I have an answer. My wife taught me this. She's a social worker and a great mom. Everybody all over the world, no matter whether they wear a penis gourd and live in a hut or live in a skyscraper in Geneva, everybody wants the same thing. We want shelter, comfort, self-respect, and food, and a feeling of possibility for ourselves and for our children. What's different is how we then go about finding it, right? So the person in the village in Papua New Guinea obviously has a different way of going after those things than someone in a Wall Street skyscraper. But it's really essential as a justice advocate to drop down to that very human level to realize, you know, that by and large, the people involved in these things are not evil. There are some evil ones out there, but the majority of business people, the majority of people we deal with all over the world are not evil. They just maybe have a different way of trying to attain those same things that we want. And if you can really grab that concept, it takes a lot of the anger, I'll speak personally, out of my heart and makes it easier for me to communicate with people, because it's really a question of how we go about achieving our goals. The goals, I really believe, are the same.
Thank you. How do we, this is from the audience now, how do we, the people, change the corporate greed structure in the USA to get the narrow spot at the top of the pyramid less restrictive and a better system?
Well, that was about 500 questions. But I think that every one of us has our own place to attack this, you know, whether you're a business person, a journalist, a mom at home, wherever you are, the issue is how can you show up with your highest values to model to the people around you the way the world should be? To be honest with you, I've fought with Procter & Gamble for 30 years now, since long before Coffee Kids, about getting them to change their corporate culture. And I've had friends come and go as consultants trying to change corporate culture. To me, frankly, corporate culture is a dinosaur. And it has to slowly die off, unless some big meteor comes and strikes Wall Street. It has to die off because it's going to be replaced by a different ecosystem. So I think it's essential for us all within our own sphere to act with our highest values in whatever we do. And that fans out into our communities. And then our next generation starts to come up with a different set of values. And I've seen that already, because having done this now, you know, lecturing in schools basically since the mid-80s, I've actually seen a change in the students' expectations. I remember in the 1970s when I graduated, you know, we all wanted to be environmental lawyers and activists, right? And then what happened? It sort of disappeared for about 20 years. But when I speak at colleges now, I feel like I'm right back in the mid-70s, because the students really want a life of meaning. They want to save this planet. They want to change the dynamics. And yeah, there are plenty of them going to financial institutions and Wall Street, but way more of them are trying to figure out how to live a life of values. And so I'm very encouraged with the evolution that's happening now. And it's not because we're forcing those companies to change. It's because people are changing, and then the consumers are changing and demanding change. So companies resist by bogus marketing, but ultimately that gets worn down too. There are actually a lot of pretty good companies out there now that weren't there over the last 20 years. So I think that moral arc is starting to bend, but it really takes everybody to keep your eye on the ball and act in a way that sends out that energy of morality and ethics and keeps it alive.
Thank you. How can Dean's Beans be profitable if it's paying double the market price?
That should tell you something about the world of coffee, about the enormous and, I will say, gross profits in the coffee sector. It's shocking. At the turn of the millennium, there was a coffee crisis. Most people don't even know about it, but about 5 million farm families lost their land. The price of coffee in the world market plummeted to about 60 cents a pound, and it takes 65 cents for a farmer to grow it. So back in 97 through 2001, every cup of coffee we drank drove a farm family deeper and deeper in debt, whether we knew it or not. It's just what was happening. At that time, Starbucks, for example, and Green Mountain, too, had the highest corporate profits they ever had. Why? Because their cost of goods dropped by 50%, but they never dropped their prices. And Wall Street then rewarded them for being such profitable companies. How perverse. Well, what do we do at Dean's Beans? You're right. It's a great question. I think we're about 6% after-tax profits, which are very healthy. Well, we also have a pension plan, for a fully funded company pension plan for all employees. We have 100% health care. We pay everything for all our employees. No premiums, no copay, no nothing. We pay it because I believe health care is a right and people can't afford it. So we pay it. So how are we profitable? Well, I didn't say we weren't smart business people. We don't use distributors. Distributors take about 25%. So why would I want to work three times as hard to be in the same place economically? We're not looking at growth. Growth is an outcome, not a goal. So we could have tripled overnight when Whole Foods wanted to take us national, but I looked at it and said, wow, that means we'd have to sell, the company would have to become three times larger than it is to satisfy Whole Foods. That means we'd have to have a second shift. We'd have to change things. Our company culture is so precious, and a few of you folks have been down to Dean's Beans and Orange, and I invite you all to come. It's such a precious place that I wouldn't give that up for more money. I don't need a second boat. I got a leaky wooden boat as is. I don't need a second leaky wooden boat. And the statistics are that families of wealth lose it in the third generation. So why do I want to do that anyway? My kids are only going to piss it away, frankly. So, and I've spoken to them about that, and they said, yes, we will, as soon as we get a hold of it. So we're very smart business people, and I think there are ways of acting responsibly where profit is reasonable but not egregious, and you live a good life. Final comment on that, I was lecturing at Harvard Law School a couple years ago, and at the question session, one of the students said, so what exactly is your after-tax profit? I said, okay, enough. He said, what? I said, it's enough. What is enough? Well, at the end of the day, we've paid all our bills, funded the pension plan, done all our development work. We have a profit-sharing program with farmers and all our employees. And at the end of the year, we're still paying taxes because we're still profitable. That's enough. And it was enough was not a concept you learn in business school. And it was really interesting to see the students struggle with the concept of what's enough. But it is a concept that we have to relearn. We used to have that, you know, the humility of knowing what's enough. Got to work on that one.
How are the coffee middlemen, the brokers, responding to your relationship with growers?
Well, the fair trade movement represents something about 10% of coffee sales in the world now, which is big because the coffee industry around the world is hundreds of billions of dollars. So frankly, there's plenty of room for bad behavior. So the middlemen have plenty of other work to do. They've still got Folgers. They've still got Starbucks. Starbucks is not a fair trade company. I think Starbucks is about 3% fair trade right now, which I once said at a Starbucks business meeting. I said, how can you justify that? In a room full of 100 farmers, you say, you, you, and you, we're going to treat you fairly. The rest of you, hit the road. How can you do that? Fairness is an underlying ethical construct. It's not a commodity. But we disagree. We respectfully disagree on that. There's plenty of room out there for middlemen. And in truth, middlemen provide, you know, they provide a needed faculty for people up in the mountains to get their coffee down if they're not in co-ops. So, you know, there's plenty of farmers to be led into co-ops and farmers. I think there are 400 groups on the waiting list right now to become recognized co-ops at the International Fair Trade. There's so much more to do. The middlemen don't have to worry anytime in the near future.
Okay. How do you communicate with people who speak only an indigenous language?
That's a great question. And there's two answers to it. Obviously, when I go into communities, there's somebody with me who can speak the intermediate language. I speak Japanese, Spanish, Indonesian, pretty well my Indonesian, and Portuguese. So I've got a lot of the farmers covered. But I make it a point before going into any indigenous communities to take advantage of Google or to take advantage of embassies, to call the embassy and say, is there anyone there who can teach me how to say a few words in Tsuut'il? Yeah, okay. Or I can go online and find out. And I learn some very basic words, and I often try to put together a little speech. So then when I go to an indigenous community for the first time, instead of being, you know, let me call it, the big white guy in the reflecting glasses, El Jefe, looking around at these people who are so used to hierarchy that they sort of just immediately genuflect because here's the new boss in town. Instead, I go in there with humility and I try to deliver a talk in their language. It's always a mess, and they always find it very, very humorous. I won't even tell you some of the words I've used and how they translate, but it's often very funny. And they egg me on and correct the words and stuff. And it's just such a beautiful way to be introduced to a community that communication barrier simply doesn't exist. Between the translator who's there and what I can share and just that sense of let's create a community together, I'm here to work with you and I'm trying to learn your language, even though nobody else in the world outside of probably a 5-mile radius speaks this language, I'm going to try. That the sense of respect I broadcast out from that is really well received. And so communication, you know something? It's never been a barrier.
Why can't local farmers organize themselves? Why do they need you?
It's a great question, but it's the same up here. I mean, if you don't have the information and if you don't have the technical tools, you're not going to be able to do something. A farmer out in the middle of the Huehuetenango Mountains in Guatemala, you know, they may have never heard the word cooperative. You know, they don't know how to organize a legal cooperative. Does anybody here know how to organize a legal cooperative? Probably not. One time I was given a talk at a business school, and one of the students said, well, if the farmers are having so much trouble making a living selling coffee, why don't they do something else? And I said, like start an IT company? You know, you have to remember what we're talking about. We're talking about people who live, you know, they're disenfranchised people even within their own national sphere, and they live way up in the mountains. Most of them don't have electricity. So it's not that, you know, I'm coming down with some northern hierarchical notion, because largely in indigenous communities, the concept of cooperation is quite well embedded. So it's not that you're actually teaching a new concept, but you're bringing in a new legal format and a new way of accessing a market that people have never had access to, right? Most of these farmers, by the way, sell their coffee in cherry. I don't know if you've ever seen a coffee tree. There are cherries all over it. You pick the cherry and then you squeeze the fruit out of it, or you send it through a machine and squeezes the fruit and out pops a pit. You dry that pit and that's the coffee bean. Starts in a cherry. Most coffee farmers around the world sell the cherry to the middleman. They don't process any further than that. But in the fair trade world and the cooperative world, what we do is help farmers form those cooperatives and then start taking on more and more upstream processing. With most of the co-ops I work with, we started out with them just selling cherry on the market, and now they own all the upstream processing through the export license. So all that processing and all that money is going back to the community, not going to outside people. But if you met Jose on his 1-acre farm in the hills of Matagalpa in Nicaragua that first day, and you say to him, hey, Jose, how'd you like to own a business and do all the processing and have an export and do all the paperwork for exporting? He'd look at you like you're insane. I mean, I'd look like I was insane if someone said the same thing to me. Who knows how to do these things? So it's not like we're saying people are stupid and we come in there and we do all these wonderful things for them. It's that we come in with a specific skill base and technique and share that with people, and they're off and running. The cooperatives we work with now run around and form other cooperatives. You know, it's not like we're doing it all the time. And plenty of farmers do form their own cooperatives. But if they want to have access to the international markets, there's some serious skills you got to learn to do it well. And cooperatives do fail. It's no guarantee. You know, several of the cooperatives I've worked with over the years have failed, just like every other business. And then the farmers shrug their shoulders and move on and maybe go form other cooperatives. It's a very dynamic and interesting world.
Thank you. Thank you again, Dean Sikon, for sharing your time and expertise with us today.
Thank you. Let's have some coffee.